The second case for oral argument this morning is Ted Blackburn, appellant versus State of South Dakota Appellee, where the appellant is Mr. Paul Winter, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee is Mr. Andrew Connect, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Winter, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As I prepared to discuss this case here today with you, it became apparent to me that some of my frustrations in trying to illuminate what the appellant's greatest concerns are is that these things occurred in such an unusual context in this case. It was November 8th, in 2007 when police were summoned to the home of Tammy Magic to find her bludgeoned to death. Now, for the next 20-plus months, the state and the defense operated essentially on the same set of facts and evidence in preparing for that trial. It included, for the state, the best evidence being that the defendant, Blackburn, had made statements that he had stabbed, hit, and even with the rock someone until things broke, that he had been at the scene, that he had been seen with the victim immediately therefore and had actually blood of hers on his clothing. For the defense, it was that Aaron Jones was present also, that when he summoned police to the scene, he affected CPR on a body already in rigor and pretended as though there was a drowning victim. It appeared as though the scene had been staged. Those are some of the facts, and I know you have them from the brief, but those were the facts, some of which we had relied upon up until preparing for the trial. It was only on the Friday before the trial then when we first ran into the problem with Jeremy Smith. Factually, Jeremy Smith had seen Aaron Jones at the scene about an hour and a half before Jones summoned police. He was covered in blood, not Jeremy, but the Jones, and had at that point left the scene with J.C. Root, who was also with him. Both were interviewed numerous times by both law enforcement and defendant's investigator, the only changes in their story being more about how far into the scene they had gotten, how much they had seen, and both having said repeatedly, that's all we know. It's when Jeremy Smith returns on that Friday to say to the defense investigator, when I sent him over there to see if anything had changed, yep, I've got something else to say. I think I overheard a conversation involving robbing her. That's about all we knew because he wanted a deal. We told him to get an attorney. Called the state. They were on their way over there already. They called me when they were done. We had a hearing where I initially objected to that evidence coming in and withdrew it later in the day, realizing that I still had Root. J.C. Root to say, that never happened. I've never said that that happened, as well as Aaron Jones, who had a completely different story. On Saturday, it's my understanding that the state pulled the deal with Jones, which I learned of on Sunday at 3:15 in the afternoon. It was Monday that they informed the court Jones likely wouldn't testify because of the problem with what was said. However, back on Friday was the first time the state characterized this new testimony as conspiracy. I mean, and the reason I bring this up, the contextual environment in which these things occurred, that didn't click with me. And it wasn't, and it was then, I believe, that the judge says, well, you might have a problem with Root pleading the fifth. You wouldn't object to that, Winter, would you? I think is how I put it. And I said, no, I didn't know what I was going to do. I realized at that time there was inferences that could be raised from a plea of the fifth on the stand, but at that time I didn't recognize that it potentially could implicate my client worse than he already was. I thought it would just make Jones even look more like a possible killer in this instance.
Okay, so why isn't that invited error? When the judge, you know, says you have an objection, or not, and you say, no, I don't have an objection, I'm going to go ahead and let Jones testify. Why isn't that invited error?
Well, I think that I began with the context of it to try and help the court understand where my mindset was. I certainly didn't...
You're asking us to fault the judge. You're saying we should say that the judge erred, plain error, that he erred in allowing this to come in. When he asks you, are you going to object? And you say, no, I'm not going to object.
To begin with, his statement to me was, you're not going to object to that, are you? I guess I read into that the ruling before the objection. I'm not going to say that I recognize the error either, as well as I should have.
Well, it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, as I heard you just argue, it was your strategy at that point to make it look like someone else was guilty.
Absolutely. From the very beginning.
How can invited error be plain error? Isn't that a contradiction in terms? You invite the judge to make a mistake and you say, no, I didn't object to it, but it's plain error. I mean, you used that error you thought you were going to use it to your advantage. It didn't work out that way, but why is that the judge's fault? Why are we being asked to say the judge erred?
Let me take a step back. When this began, it began with unsure testimony. We didn't know what it was going to be. Something about a conversation involving robbing and or killing. However, we weren't sure what that testimony would be. At this point, I hear the judge suggest this could cause a Fifth Amendment problem for this other witness. The state then says, we're not sure, I don't want to mislead the court. I'm not trying to say this is chronologically exactly correct. In that same Friday to Monday time period, the state suggests, I cannot assure the court, this is a prosecutor, that Jones will invoke. Jones instead is, attorney has advised us that he will, that he has advised him to invoke, but we have reason to believe, we're not sure he'll follow his attorney's advice. And that, I responded simply at that point by saying, I can't get a hold of this attorney. And I tried all weekend and put that in the record. I don't understand what they're going to do. The difference between the invited error and plain error in this case is I wasn't attempting to invite error. If I had invited error by saying, I'm not going to object to him taking the stand, which I didn't. I admit I didn't because I couldn't foresee the problem with him taking the stand.
We think of plain error as where a counsel sits silent when the counsel should have said something. I object, Your Honor. That's usually how plain error, counsel doesn't do anything. But here you're invited to say, are you going to object or not? And you specifically say, no, I'm not objecting. So that goes beyond, it seems to me, just a passive allowing an answer to come in that shouldn't have come in. Maybe it isn't invited error. Maybe that's too strong a word, but certainly the judge is looking out for the interest of your client and asks you if you're going to object, and you say no.
And I didn't take the judge's admonition to me when he said, you're not going to object to that, are you? I didn't know what it meant. I'm telling the court that at that point I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know why the state would say in one breath, well, his attorney says he's going to plead the fifth, yet maybe he's not. I wasn't sure what was happening with Jeremy Smith other than what his attorney was telling me was that he's not going to testify because the state can't give him what he wants.
All right. Well, where's the error? What are you claiming is the error in the record on what happened?
The error in the record is that both those witnesses were on the stand in front of the jury refusing to testify, one by invoking the right against self-incrimination and the other simply refusing, apparently according to his attorney, because he wasn't able to get a deal.
Okay, but you didn't object to this?
No.
So you're relying on plain error of the court?
Effectively, I am.
Letting this happen?
Yes.
Well, the second one is even more, I mean, the second one does really approach, I mean, with Mr. Smith, that does kind of approach invited error, because you had a motion in limine to preclude him from testifying, and you withdrew it. So he could testify.
I had a motion to preclude him from testifying about this new evidence.
Right, okay.
And I wanted him to continue to not be able to do that.
Right.
I withdrew it against Smith and then asserted my objection very clearly that that testimony should not come in with the remaining witness who would say something about it that I learned of after Vore Dyer, which was J.C. Root, who is the person who was with Smith apparently when this alleged drug deal was going to occur. That's when I renewed my objection. Then I asked the court to not allow any testimony regarding that instance into evidence for the reason that I felt it was untested, I didn't have time to investigate it, and thirdly, that it was testimony that was more prejudicial than it would be probative. It felt it was self-serving at that point for the state to put that into evidence without it being reasonably challenged.
Are you talking about Root now?
Yes, I am. And it was Root that the state called in to talk to him about Smith's new testimony on Monday after the jury was seated. And until that point, I didn't think then that this was coming in because of what Smith said. And so I'm thinking there's two guys potentially who could take the stand and refuse to testify, and I couldn't see to what end. I simply didn't understand. Why would the state put two guys on the stand to refuse to testify when it doesn't link them to this drug deal anymore?
Isn't that your error? To be frank, many of us have tried lawsuits, and things don't go the way trial lawyers always plan them. And you make a decision, and you find out the next day, you shouldn't have done this or that. But isn't that your mistake as opposed to the judge's mistake? That's plain error isn't trial lawyer error. It's court error.
I think there's no question I erred in not objecting now. I don't think that's a question. Yes, it was a legitimate question. Not saying you didn't ask a legitimate question. I'm agreeing with you. I should have objected. I think if I had objected, then it would have given the court another opportunity to examine what was happening. I think also, however, that when they went on the stand and the first question they're asked is their name, and the second question, what is involved for Jones, what was your involvement in the death of Tamara Magic on that day, it indicates the state purposefully provoked that invocation of that right. Now, even in that situation, I didn't anticipate, and I don't think I should be expected to, assuming I make the first error, not objecting to getting up there thinking he might invoke at some point. He wasn't asked anything foundationally. Was he there? Was he around? Who do you know? Any foundational questions that you would normally expect a witness to be asked. I thought there would be a moment, at least in between times, to see where this would be heading.
Well, wasn't part of your trial strategy to point to Jones? Say, that's the guy?
Absolutely. It's exactly was the thrust of the defense coming in here. And I spent twenty-some months.
Well, the state hadn't called him, you may have.
I wouldn't have called him to invoke at that point.
Well, the state didn't even know at that point for sure he was going to invoke, did they?
Well, they said they didn't, and I don't know what the basis for that was. They said his attorney said he would, but they didn't. They had reason to believe he wouldn't. If I was to believe that, then I guess it eliminates my error. To some extent, I guess I should believe the state on that one too. But I didn't. I didn't understand.
Well, how is the trial court supposed to anticipate all of this and decide it on plain error?
Well, to some extent, I don't blame the trial court for not expecting what I expected, that the state would ask some questions that would be relevant. I felt he had relevant information about the case that he would not invoke his Fifth Amendment right for. I thought he would probably be asked some questions about that. I anticipated that I would be able to cross-examine him on those issues.
It certainly looks like the question sets him up to take the Fifth. Ordinarily, these things are done in chambers. If somebody thinks someone's going to take the Fifth, rather than having that possibly taint the jury. The judge brings the witness into chambers with counsel, and then the questions are asked. Was that discussed here? Was that considered?
No. And again, I can accept responsibility for my role in that. There was a lot going on. This was one part of a lot of things that were happening during that trial and different witnesses that were trying to be rounded up. These aren't the kind of witnesses that you find, say, in an embezzlement case where they're at their businesses and they're doing what they should be doing. We're, you know, and I don't want to try to, and I'm not trying to excuse my own conduct. What I am trying to say is there was lots of things going on that at this point, while I was troubled by what was happening, I didn't see it for what I see it today.
But isn't that, couldn't you also say that that was probably true of the state as well? And that's what they said in the record, that they weren't sure either. Both these witnesses had attorneys, correct?
Yes.
Assuming there was discussion. And it wasn't until the very end that anybody really knew what was going to happen, and the only way to find out was to call him and put him on the stand. And then as far as the Smith witness, the state actually gave him immunity. How was that error?
I felt like, you know, looking back to the first part of your comment, when they didn't know what was going on, I think that they started in exactly the same position I did. In fact, they were in the jail finding out what Smith had to say shortly after I did.
So then we can't call this prosecutorial misconduct.
Not at that point. At that point, I wouldn't say that they had caused the genesis of this story, that in any way there was some kind of scheme to bring down the defense to its knees through clever, you know, mischievous means. It was later what I see as the prosecutorial misconduct. There comes a point that the state becomes very aware that they are going to put someone on the stand. Now, that is a rule I think is objectionable, certainly, but I think it's not just objectionable, it's wrong to do it fundamentally. Anytime that any party, in the cases that I read, would put somebody on the stand, they're doing it improperly. It's rarely, if ever, something that will be more probative than prejudicial. But back to the point where the state is going to then put them on the stand and ask simply the name, and then what was your involvement in the death of Tamara Magic on November 8th, 2007? I think that that indicates that there was a purpose at this point.
But then again, you did not object. And in most cases, I mean, I think that's why we say you need to object to these things so that the trial court can police it and make sure it doesn't happen and that the defendant gets a fair trial, which could have happened here had you objected, correct?
Possibly. I can't, you know. I think that there, it's a very... I want the court to understand when I failed to object at that point, however... When J.C. Root is getting on the stand in the next moment, I've known about J.C. Root's change in testimony for approximately 24 hours, half of which was filled with trial, the afternoon, the morning, and then he comes on in the afternoon. I didn't know what he was going to say. When he responded to the state's question, when he was asking about what had occurred, the gist of the testimony was, here comes these two guys, Smith and Root, in a vehicle to sell cocaine to Blackburn and Jones. The prosecutor asks, when Jeremy Smith asked, do you want to buy this cocaine? Blackburn responds, looks over at Jones and says, you down to do this? And the state's attorney says, what was his demeanor when he said that? And he said, like he was going to rob and kill Tammy. I objected. I thought that wasn't demeanor. I didn't know that this was the kind of testimony that was coming. I did not. I felt that it was that wasn't intentionally provoking the client to ask him his demeanor, but that then I was beginning to understand that there was a direction that this testimony and the silence from Jones was going. I do complain in my brief that Smith took the stand and refused to testify. However, I felt the state had a right to put someone on the stand to refuse to testify. Right or wrong at the time, that's what I thought was okay. I thought it was okay to put someone on the stand to refuse to testify. But I didn't think it was okay then to ask questions like, do you have an attorney in the room? Yeah. And then to ask him about immunity there. I thought he had been granted immunity. I knew he had been granted immunity. I didn't think that was going to happen on the stand. Did I object then? No. So but it really didn't sew up what was happening to me.
Was Root's version of this consistent with any other of the versions in the police report or anything like that?
No. It was new.
So what, had you known this, you know, what is what would you have done differently, or what were you asking for that would have happened?
Had I known,
you couldn't stop him from testifying, correct?
Correct.
So what would you, where is the error?
The error, I couldn't stop them from testifying at that point. What I thought was a new prosecution theory, now I look back and see it as a new prosecution theory developing during trial. Now, the state was reacting, I admit, to new evidence that was coming in or new testimony that they wanted to put on. They had a motive problem and a premeditation problem from the beginning. Nobody knew why Tamara Magic was bludgeoned to death. Nobody. This was, you know, great evidence for the state to be able to say, now we know why this was done. It was terribly damaging and prejudicial evidence to the defense, however true it may or may not be. But the error that I found looking back at it was that the state intentionally plowed ahead, putting witnesses on that they knew were going to do this. You know, whether or not I should at that moment object or move for a mistrial or ask that this thing be stopped in its tracks, I couldn't know what the next person or what the other evidence, how it would tie in. I couldn't scramble fast enough to figure out what was happening. I had a very clear defense coming into it.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Connect, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I agree with Mr. Winter that it's important to start with the context of what happened in the days before the trial started. As Mr. Winter had said, the very first indication of this new evidence coming in for both the state and the defense was Mr. Smith telling the defense investigators that he had overheard this conversation between Mr. Blackburn and Mr. Jones about a possible sale and inferences about what they're going to do and so on. At that time, Mr. Winter had actually thought that he was going to, he had issued an oral motion to in limine for this new evidence, which he later withdrew. I believe during the hearing on Friday, the court did at the time asked Mr. Winter what his plans for this were, and Mr. Winter indicated to the court that he had spoken with his client, and rather than object to this new evidence or ask for a continuance, they were just going to attack the evidence as is at trial. And I think that becomes important when discussing J.C. Root's testimony later on. With this evidence, the state then began to question what to do about Aaron Jones, because at that point, Aaron Jones was going to be one of the state's forefront witnesses, and he had been offered a plea deal. Well, that fell through over the course of the weekend based on this new information. Now the state is going to reopen its investigation into Mr. Jones and start asking if he had more of an involvement in Ms. Magic's death than the state first realized. And at this point also, there was the new testimony from Mr. Smith. And then on the Monday of the trial, it was the Sunday before that the state had learned that Mr. Smith might not testify despite the state wanting to grant him immunity. And then it was during the trial after voir dire that the state learned that J.C. Root had also been a part of that conversation. In regards to Mr. Jones, I think Mr. Winter did say that part of his trial strategy was to make Mr. Jones look guilty and to implicate him in this crime. and it was part of his trial strategy to basically let the state question him. And Mr. Winter did say that the state, nor he nor the state knew at the time that Mr. Jones, if he was for sure, was not going to take the fifth. That was when the trial court did ask, the state did inform the trial court and the defense of their intention to call Mr. Jones despite knowing that he might take the fifth. That is when the trial court directly asked Mr. Winter, do you have any objection to this? And Mr. Winter said no, which is why we're looking at this under a plain error standard. Then, concerning J.C. Root's testimony, actually, I'll back up. Concerning Mr. Smith's testimony, Mr. Smith was called to the stand. At that point, neither the defense or the state knew if he was going to testify, and the state did offer Mr. Smith immunity from his involvement in the drug transaction on that day, and he still refused to testify and was found in contempt by the court. So at that time, the state really, we did want Mr. Smith to testify, and he simply refused to. And as you said before, sometimes those happens, those type of things happen during trial.
Why though? You know, in my experience, I guess I haven't seen these kinds of things take place in front of the jury. Usually that's done in chambers. Is there, why were these witnesses, why did you go through the Fifth Amendment exercise in front of the jury?
The reason for that was, I believe it was part of the state's trial strategy, with referring to Mr. Jones, how he took the Fifth Amendment. The state's trial strategy at that time was basically to counter the defendant's assertion that Mr. Jones was to make him look guilty. I think Mr. Winter had said that they wanted to make Aaron Jones look guilty and incriminate him in his role in this, and the state, and during Mr. Winter's opening argument and proceeding throughout the trial, he would make comments that the state was being negligent in their investigation of Mr. Jones. He, I think at one point, said, why isn't Mr. Jones sitting in my client's chair? And why isn't the state investigating his clothing? Where's Mr. Jones involved in all this? And the idea that the state had for calling Mr. Jones was basically so the jury would see him invoke the fifth and say, okay, here's why Mr. Jones isn't being subpoenaed. Here's why he's not testifying, because he's going to take the fifth. Whether or not that was a winning strategy or a great strategy, or whether or not they could have done it differently.
What about this allegation that the state changed the theory into a theory of conspiracy in the middle of this trial?
I don't see any evidence of that. The state, from the beginning of the trial to the end, the state's theory was always Mr. Blackburn killed Tamara Magic. That is what the evidence points to, and that's what we're arguing. The state never once, after Mr. Jones had taken the stand and got off, the state never made a reference to him again, except in the context of responding to defendant's allegations. The state had never tried to say, here's this big conspiracy. It was all, I think, the defendant even refers to it as inference and innuendo. And the state never said anything that would support a claim of that. I think that was just speculation on the part of the defendant, and the state actually spent a lot of time during the trial trying to steer the jury away from that notion.
Were there any jury instructions that would have allowed the jury to determine a conspiracy?
I don't recall instructions on conspiracy. I could be mistaken. Concerning the testimony of Mr. Root. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't finish your question, Your Honor. The testimony of Mr. Smith, that one is, of that witness, Mr. Jones had taken the Fifth Amendment, and that was largely based on the fact that the state had revoked his plea agreement the Sunday before the trial began. As with Mr. Smith, as the defendant had said, the state didn't know for sure whether or not he was going to testify at that time. The state had offered him immunity. The state had done everything in its power to compel him to testify. And as I said, that simply didn't work. And so we were left with calling Mr. Root to the stand. I know that the defendant characterizes that as trial by surprise or ambush, but the state would disagree in the sense that Mr. Root was essentially testifying to the same thing that Mr. Smith was going to testify to. They were two men in a car that overheard the same conversation. It wasn't until the Monday before trial that J.C. Root did come forward and say, yes, I heard this as well. But this was information that the defendant had before the beginning of the trial, and it was basically just coming through another witness.
So was he aware that he was changing his testimony? Was the defense aware of the change of testimony of Root prior to them taking the stand?
I don't believe that the defendant was aware that Root was going to be changing his testimony prior to taking the stand.
The state was, however.
I don't know that the state knew for a fact. I think that they had inferred because of his involvement. Again, I could be mistaken on that as well.
Did Root have a lawyer too?
I don't believe so. However, again, the defendant did issued no objection to his testimony and was given an opportunity to extensively cross-examine Mr. Root about his involvement with the case.
How did that cross-examination satisfy his concerns here on Root?
Well, I believe his concerns with Root was that he was basically coming up against a witness that I think he claims he wasn't prepared for his testimony. Whereas in this case, since Root didn't refuse to testify and that Root actually did testify, the defendant was given the opportunity to cross-examine him as he would any other witness. And as for addressing the defendant's concerns about prosecutorial misconduct, I don't believe that is the case here. Everything that the state knew, either the defense knew first or notified the defendant and gave him an opportunity to object. The judge asked him point blank if he objected to Aaron Jones's involvement. He didn't. He asked him. The defendant asserted that he wasn't going to seek a continuance after finding out the information from Mr. Smith. The state immediately informed the defendant of the new testimony from Mr. Root as soon as they discovered it, and he was given the opportunity to cross-examine him. The state didn't invent a whole new theory of prosecution midway through the trial. The state said in its closing that here is our theory, here's what we believe happened, and here's the evidence for you. And so I don't think that there's any foundation for a complaint of prosecutorial misconduct in this case. And that is what I have, unless there are questions.
Thank you, Mr. Keck. No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Mr. Winter, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your
Honor. The state indicated they didn't believe that plain error was here, and I think that has been the major question that has been posed to me. Plain error requires four things, my understanding of South Dakota law, and that is error that is plain, that affects substantial rights, that seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. First of all, error, I'm taking from the court's comments, has to be judicial error. I don't know. Let me back up. Throughout this entire analysis, there's always an element of what I would call prosecutorial misconduct that seems to be under an undercurrent of every one of these analyses. The Namath Court, when they addressed the two versions of complaints regarding putting people on to invoke the Fifth, seemed to say that there's one version that is clearly involves prosecutorial misconduct, and yet another where in the given circumstances of a case, the state is able to add critical weight to their case in a form not subject to cross-examination. I'm not going to dispute for one second that I didn't try to make as much hay and flip the inferences that I feel are now prejudicial against the prosecution. I felt that was my only avenue at the time. But was there error in the state calling them to the stand? Yes. Was there error in allowing them to proceed? Yes. Should I have objected? Probably another error. Was it plain? I don't think that allowing someone to take the stand and not testify for the purported reason to counter the defense, that's the way I see the state's argument. We had to do it. They made me do it. And I didn't feel that I made this state do that. That was a very clear and conscious move on their part. The state stated on numerous occasions prior to them taking the stand that that was their intention. With Smith, the prosecutor said she intended to somehow, and I couldn't figure it out because she would have Crawford confrontation problems, but impeach Smith if he tried to refuse to testify, and she would provide the court with authority regarding that, which never happened. I waited for that to happen. Instead, she asked a question that caused him to immediately refuse to testify. And then, did any of these actions seriously affect the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the judicial proceedings? I think it affected the fairness. I think that the state's actions were effectually, whether or not intentional, an attack on the integrity of the court at that point. It's not, in reading some of the cases, I could find references, and they were old. It was a 71 model code, but where it said that no prosecutor should do this action, that it's fundamentally unfair. The Eighth Circuit said, defendants can't do it in the Reyes case. Why can't they do it? Well, because it creates a situation where there's untested inferences. Either case, there's untested inferences. I simply wanted to say, in closing, that for the state to continually allege that it was the defense that raised this conspiracy idea, is disingenuous. The prosecutor himself described the contested new testimony at the Friday hearing where I first challenged it. My understanding is he, meaning Smith, never disclosed his knowledge of a conspiracy between Aaron Jones and Tad Blackburn. In the record, it is the first reference I can find to calling this new testimony conspiracy. For the state to say that they didn't then present their case in a manner that changed its theory, I just don't think it's straightforward analysis. It was that, I guess, that lodged in the back of my head. So then on Monday night when I raised the issue again and said, I'm concerned about this looking like a conspiracy or felony murder click case, judge, and he said, I guess you take them like you get them. Sometimes you do. But I don't think that a change in the prosecution theory made it for a fair trial for my client. Barring any further questions, I appreciate the court's time and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Winter. Because we run on the hour due to the internet access, we'll be in recess till 11 o'clock. Court's in recess.